Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. Thank you for listening in. It looks like we can expect a sunny week with temperatures mostly in the high 50s and pretty much staying away from frost at night. There is a chance of rain on Tuesday, and then starting on Friday, we're heading into possible rain, and it's even being suggested that it could snow next Saturday, Saturday night, or Sunday. We have a full show, so let's get to it. Here's Dennis Hart with last week's news in the state of Iowa.
Thanks for joining us on this Monday. One of the stories lots of people were talking about this past week, not just in Iowa, but across the nation, was the drawing for the Mega Millions jackpot, which had climbed to an incredible $1.5 billion. No one in Iowa won that big prize. Someone in South Carolina did. But someone in Iowa did have the winning numbers in this past Saturday's $688 million Powerball jackpot. That winning ticket was sold at a Casey's convenience store in Redfield, which is about 35 miles west of Des Moines. Whoever bought that ticket will share the Powerball prize with someone else who bought another ticket with the same winning numbers in New York City. Politics also made big news around Iowa last week. No surprise there, given that the November midterm election is just around the corner. And U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont was one of those who made news when he came to Iowa State University's Memorial Union. He urged a cheering crowd of about 800 people to vote for Democrat J.D. Scholten, who is trying to defeat 8-term Republican Congressman Steve King in the 4th Congressional District. Sanders spent much of his speech blasting President Trump, calling him a pathological liar who has no political beliefs and who is an opportunist of the worst kind. Sanders also urged voters to support Democrat Deidre DeGeer in her race against Iowa's Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate. Meanwhile, there was word that Congressman King met with members of an Austrian far-right political party associated with neo-Nazi movements during an August trip that was funded by a Holocaust nonprofit organization. The meeting took place a day after King's 5-day trip to Jewish and Holocaust sites in Europe. Still on politics, California Democratic U.S. Senator Kamala Harris showed up in Iowa last week. Political experts think she'll run for president in 2020, but she would not talk about that while she was in the state. Instead, she told a crowd in Des Moines that she's focused on next week's election, saying that 2018 is going to be a pivotal year. And Minnesota Democratic U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar also showed up in Des Moines, urging Democrats there to reestablish Iowa as a place of progressive values in next week's election. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Register reported that more than $75 million in campaign money had flooded into Iowa's 2018 political races. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and her Democratic challenger Fred Hubbell have raised a record $28 million in the race for the governor's office. Also last week, Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said that he is one of the two previously unidentified senators who were the targets of death threats during the time when lawmakers were considering the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Justice Department announced that it has charged a man from Smithtown, New York, with threatening to murder and assault the senators for their support of Kavanaugh's nomination. Meanwhile, Governor Reynolds announced a new program to help Marshalltown tornado victims last week. The program, called Voluntary Agencies Leading and Organizing Repairs, has created a partnership with local volunteer agencies to provide temporary, minor emergency home repairs. The goal is to help people return to or remain in their home by completing repairs that will make the residents safe, accessible, and habitable. About 400 homes in Marshalltown may be eligible to receive assistance under the program. In Fort Dodge, violence broke out last Monday. Two brothers were killed in a shooting, the first double homicide in the city in more than a decade. 37-year-old Marion Rhodes and 34-year-old L. Dominic Rhodes, both of Fort Dodge, were killed in the attack. Officers found them lying in an alleyway behind 910 2nd Avenue North after responding to a shots fired call. A few days later, authorities announced the arrest of 28-year-old Tanner King of Fort Dodge. He was charged with two counts of first-degree murder. There was also word from Davenport that a man shot during a struggle with a sheriff's deputy there had died. Authorities said 27-year-old Robert Mitchell was shot by Deputy Greg Hill after Hill pulled over Mitchell's vehicle and an altercation broke out. There was also word last week that a Des Moines couple had pleaded not guilty in connection with the death of a toddler. 18-year-old Denver Emery and 38-year-old Nicholas Rivera were charged with endangerment causing the death of 2-year-old Calvin Trulinger, who died last May from injuries that authorities said were not accidental. Also last week, word that a man's memorial site was vandalized with gunshots on the 1-year anniversary of his death. 19-year-old Teddy Perry had fatally shot himself last October along a gravel road north of Nevada. The memorial site that was vandalized is located on that spot. A week ago, someone fired shots through the man's memorial picture, and a mailbox where people would leave messages for him was also shot twice. Days after that incident, a unique gathering took place at a home on the north side of Ames. It was the first time in Iowa that all the recipients of one organ donor got together at one time with members of the donor's family. The gathering commemorated the one-year observance of the death of Mary and Don Perry's grandson, yes, 19-year-old Teddy Perry. After he had committed suicide, his heart, lungs, liver, and two kidneys were donated and gave five people a new lease on life. There was also word last week that foster kids sent to an Iowa facility from Washington State were physically abused and kept largely segregated from the outside world. A report by a group known as Disability Rights Washington details the living conditions of foster kids sent to the for-profit Clarinda Academy, which houses about 200 children between the ages of 12 and 18. The children told investigators they were physically restrained, not allowed to have cell phones, and not allowed to make routine trips into town. In response, the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families said it will stop placing children at the Clarinda Academy. There was word that a new study ranks Iowa as the 10th highest state in the nation for childhood obesity. Nearly 18% of Iowa kids between the ages of 10 and 17 are said to be obese. Mississippi has the highest level of child obesity at 26%. Utah has the lowest rate, 9%. Also last week, the Orange City Public Library said it's exploring legal options after a Northwest Iowa man rented and then publicly burned several children's books. Paul Doerr, the director of a group called Rescue the Perishing, which he calls a pro-life, pro-family movement, threw at least four books with LGBTQ themes that he claims he rented from the public library into a burning trash can. This as the second annual OC Pride event was about to kick off. Meanwhile, an Iowa teacher was reported to be under investigation by the Davenport School District last week after she was pictured at a public Halloween party wearing blackface. Megan Luloff, a first-grade teacher at Walcott Elementary, was dressed as a female character from the movie Napoleon Dynamite during a function at the Walcott American Legion. The Davenport District School Superintendent said, in his words, "Wearing blackface is never appropriate in any circumstance by any person." Also last week, trial was scheduled in a gender discrimination lawsuit filed by a former school district official in northern Iowa. Mason City School's former Human Resources Director, Jody Anderson, had filed the suit, alleging that men employed by the district were being paid more than women for the same categories of work. Her trial will begin in 2020. Meanwhile, there was a report last week that women in Iowa earn $10,637 less than men on average. That's one of the nation's wider gaps in pay. The American Association of University Women's annual report on the gender pay gap ranked Iowa 31st for its gap between the sexes. In Iowa, the report said, women earn 79 cents for every dollar men earn. Across the nation, women working full-time earn 80 cents for every dollar paid to a man. The women's pay gap is smallest in California. It's biggest in Louisiana. Also last week, a report that racist graffiti had been discovered on three murals on the east side of Des Moines. The murals are within a few blocks of each other on East Grand Avenue. Nearby property and business owners were said to be upset and disturbed by the graffiti. Also last week, it was reported that a county attorney in southern Iowa was charged with public intoxication after a county deputy saw her drunk in a courtroom. Clark County Attorney Michelle Rivera was said to be slurring her words and stumbling on her feet. In a statement, Rivera apologized and said, in her words, "I am taking every step necessary to get help to fix this problem and to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again." Rivera is up for re-election this year. Also last week, word that the city of Des Moines took another step to piece together the land it needs to extend one of its bicycle and pedestrian trails and unlock access to Easter Lake on the city's southeast side. The city council approved the $294,000 acquisition of a 14-acre parcel, the second of three pieces of land needed before the final design can proceed. And Polk County supervisors approved a $2.5 million loan to the owner of the Merle Hay Mall, which the owner says will let her company buy and redevelop two spaces left vacant by the closure of the Sears and Yonkers stores. The loan will be repaid over 15 years with a 1% interest rate. Also last week, word that the Fairway Stores Company had partnered with Boone High School to launch the first registered high school meat-cutting apprenticeship in the state of Iowa. Participants will be able to complete coursework online. The program will be available to high schools across Iowa. And, of course, this past last weekend of October, college football made big news around Iowa. Iowa State University defeated Texas Tech 40-31. The University of Iowa lost to Penn State 30-24. And the University of Northern Iowa also lost 37-17 against Western Illinois. And that is your summary of the past week's news from around the state. I'm Dennis Hart, hoping your week is a winner, and reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday with a look at the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
And that was Dennis Hart with news from Iowa from the past week, and this is Local Talk. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. On Friday, the conservative-leaning Sioux City Journal editorial board endorsed Democratic challenger J.D. Scholten in an unprecedented switch from their usual support of Steve King for the U.S. House seat in the Iowa's 4th District. According to them, quote, "these were not easy words for us to write," unquote. They cited the impact on our district of King's, quote, "inflammatory or questionable comments. Each time King immerses himself in controversy, he holds up this district to ridicule and marginalizes himself within the legislative body within he serves, neither of which provides benefit to Iowans who live and work here," unquote. So that was a notable switch for the King and Scholten campaigns. And as I'm sure you know, 11 people were killed and more were wounded on October 27th when a synagogue, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, was attacked by a gunman. That same day, the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa issued a statement condemning the anti-Semitic violence in Pittsburgh. And today, faith leaders and other community members will hold a vigil for the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the Des Moines Jewish community, and all others who experience hate. Connie Ryan, Executive Director of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, is on the phone with us to tell us more about what's happening in Des Moines today. Connie, thank you for joining us again so soon on Local Talk.
As I said to you earlier, I hope that someday we can have a conversation that does not involve the subject of hate.
We have to stop meeting this way.
Right.
So thank you, Connie. And would you please read the statement that the Interfaith Alliance issued?
I would be happy to do that. We titled it Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Condemns Anti-Semitic Violence in Pittsburgh. And the statement reads as follows. "For the second time in a month, I am releasing a statement regarding hate and anti-Semitism, this one at the farthest end of the spectrum of extremism, hate, and violence. A man filled with hate and rage walked into a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with the sole purpose of killing Jews, innocent people peacefully worshiping, people practicing their faith in a country that demands the ability of all people to choose their own beliefs, people who were not safe in their own sanctuary. Every person in this country should be angry and in mourning that this level of hatred is not only present, but is growing in our country. The political rhetoric that is fueling extremism and hate is dangerous and has real consequences. Interfaith Alliance of Iowa calls upon all elected officials, including President Donald Trump and Representative Steve King, all faith leaders, and every citizen to condemn this horrific action and to stand in solidarity with neighbors and friends who are Jewish to protect them against any further violence or hate." That was the statement we made on Saturday.
Thank you. Tell us what is being planned for today.
We began conversations with the Jewish community to check in with them to see how they were doing. And they had already begun conversation of, you know, what should we do publicly. And together, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa and leaders in the Jewish community put together a vigil that will be occurring in Des Moines tonight at 5:30 at Tiferet Israel Synagogue at 924 Polk Boulevard in Des Moines. If you're familiar with Roosevelt High School, it's essentially across the street from Roosevelt. And it will be a gathering of anyone, people of faith and no faith, people of all faith, who want to stand in support not only for those who lost their lives and were injured and were impacted at the Tree of Life Synagogue, but also in solidarity with our friends in the greater Des Moines Jewish community, because they really are grieving. And when your brothers and sisters in your own faith are harmed so egregiously, it impacts you and your ability to walk into your own synagogue. So we want to be there for them and stand with them and be in solidarity. So again, at Tiferet Israel Synagogue, 924 Polk Boulevard, tonight at 5:30.
Connie, what can one expect if one goes to that vigil? Do you know what's going to be happening there?
Yeah, it really will be a lot of different things. There's five or six different faith leaders speaking from different traditions, as well as the rabbi from Tiferet Israel and the rabbi from Temple Benai. I will be speaking. There will be prayers from the Jewish tradition. I think there'll be some music. It's really a service of not only of mourning, but also of hope. You know, what can we do as Iowan to help stem this tide of hate and violence that we're seeing? What can we do in our own lives? So probably some statements of challenge to engage people in making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is open to anybody, right?
Open to anyone. And we just felt the need to wrap ourselves around the Jewish community here in the Des Moines area and give them support, and also to honor the folks in Pittsburgh who lost their lives or were impacted by this horrific action that one man took against them.
I know that it's very possible that somebody listening to this broadcast might want to join but has never been in a synagogue. Is there any protocol or dress code or anything that somebody feels they have to know in order to come to the synagogue, to the vigil?
It's a really good question. When we enter other spaces that we're not familiar with, particularly worship spaces, most people want to be very respectful of that. There's not any dress code. Come as you are. Anyone is welcome. It looks like a traditional worship space, pews and that kind of thing. So if you're familiar with Christian churches, it looks very similar in setting. You don't have to wear anything particular. So just come as you are, and you will be welcomed at the door and be able to participate.
Thank you. And is there a website where somebody can go if they want to check again the location and the time?
There's an event page on Facebook. So if you find Interfaith Alliance Iowa on Facebook, we have created an event page, and it has details about the event there. And that's been shared, I think, about 300 times. So it's out there with folks. Otherwise, if you have questions about it, you can certainly call our office, which is 515-279-8715.
Say that one more time,
515-279-8715.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Connie Ryan, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. Thank you for joining us, letting us know about that. My older sister, Lucia, was living in Pittsburgh until very recently, where, as it turns out, by coincidence, she actually was a congregation member in the very Tree of Life synagogue that was recently attacked. I asked her if I could record a firsthand description of the place to help humanize this terrible event for myself and possibly others. So here is some of what Lucia and her two 13-year-old daughters, Mariah and Samarit, shared.
The synagogue was built by the Tree of Life congregation in the 50s, I think, but it, for quite a while it's had a declining membership, and so two other congregations rent space and use the building. Tor Hadash is one of them, and that was the community that we were part of.
And so this, so different groups rent the synagogue, is that what you're saying?
Right. So the people, you know, they were friendly to each other.
And do you know which congregation was there when the shooting happened?
I think all of them had people there. On different levels of the building. Dor Hadash, the community we were with, had a study group every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock where they sit and they read a portion of the Bible. And that was scheduled to happen at 10. And then the Tree of Life congregation had a baby naming ceremony that was also set up to start somewhere in that time, around that time. And then the other congregation might have been in the basement, having a regular Saturday morning service. That's sort of how the building was used. We would often get together after our separate Sabbath services. They would all get together and have a shared lunch.
The two synagogues would have their meals together. We would always get shop at Whole Foods and get yogurts for the class. So, like, when we had snack, we would all come up. And, like, we would, after, like, having the snack with the school or whatever, we would, our whole class would rush up, like, who could get there first and get the better yogurts or whatever, and the last one up would get the worst yogurt, so we were all, like, running up there trying to get the best yogurt first or whatever. I liked chocolate, so I really liked it. Yeah. Yeah.
And what kind of a neighborhood was it in? Were the people from the neighborhood?
Yeah, a lot of people would have been from the neighborhood. Squirrel Hill, which is the Jewish neighborhood of Pittsburgh, not that far from the university. Squirrel Hill is a fun neighborhood. It's one of the oldest consistent Jewish neighborhoods in the country. A lot of Jewish neighborhoods come and then they, you know, people gentrify and they leave, and the neighborhood changes. So but Squirrel Hill has been very stable, which is unusual. So it goes way back and has always been a Jewish neighborhood. The congregation of Dor Hadash was a very educated, a very politically conscious and politically active social, a lot of social service. A lot of them were academics and artists, a very knowledgeable group of people. And a lot of them lived in that general area, which is the Jewish neighborhood and neighborhoods around the universities.
Did anybody anticipate this kind of danger?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we were shocked. It was like, why Tree of Life, you know? There are many other much more prominent synagogues in Pittsburgh. Bigger congregation, bigger building, a very odd choice. And it seems like the killer picked it because they were so active with immigrants. The Dor Hadash and Tree of Life also, I think, did care a lot about the immigrant populations in Pittsburgh. And we attended several, like, Hanukkah skating parties in December where they would invite the Nepalese. There's a large immigrant community of Nepalese. But they showed up at these Hanukkah skating parties, and then we'd all skate together. And for a lot of them, it was the first time they'd ever skated.
Oh, my God, the skating was so fun. And anyways, it was, like, their first time ever going on ice or whatever. Like, we would teach them how to ice skate on the ice, and it was, like, so much fun. We were just, like, all, like, ice skating and holding each other's hands and just, like, pulling each other around or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fun. Yeah.
So, yeah, so they were a very socially and politically conscious and active community. They put a lot of time and effort and money into that.
Well,
a very lovely, quiet group of people, and yeah, certainly don't deserve this. So.
Just, it's a bit of a shocker. 3 or 4 armed police were, like, killed. So I doubt a security guard would have been much use. Yeah, we went to a service today. It made me think of the synagogue with a whole bunch of bullet shots stuck in it. I mean, the people I prayed with, like, people I prayed with or had lunch with are now, like, dead or murdered or whatever.
And if you've just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host, and that was my older sister, Lucia, and her 2 13-year-old daughters, Samarit and Mariah, sharing their first memories of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, which was their synagogue until they just recently left the city. I appreciate their opening up to share their memories. Switching gears, Election Day is approaching fast. Last week, a forum was held in Nevada for candidates for Iowa House District 49. Candidates included Republican incumbent Dave Deo and Brenda Brink, the Democratic challenger. The forum was hosted by the League of Women Voters, and here are some highlights from that debate.
Welcome to Story County Extension in Nevada and the forum for candidates running for the open seat in Iowa House District 49. My name is Ann Kimber. I am a member of the League of Women Voters of Ames and Story County, and I am the moderator. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization with a primary mission of encouraging active, informed citizen participation in their government. The candidates joining us today are Dave Deo, Republican and incumbent, Brenda Brink, Democrat, and we also invited John Evans, Libertarian. So we'll start with Dave.
I'm State Representative Dave Deo. I have been in the legislature now for 12 years, running for re-election for House District 49, which is the towns that are in the district are everything in Story County east of I-35, including Story City and Huxley also. And then it covers the southern half of Hardin County, so it goes up to Radcliffe and Eldora. A lot of my efforts have been on budget issues. I'm on Appropriations Committee. A few years ago, back when Culver was governor and the Democrats were in the majority, I sponsored a bill that actually allowed the city of Nevada to gift this property to the fair board, because up until that point, the city had owned the fairgrounds for a lot of years since it had first been formed, and they were wanting to kind of get rid of it. The fair board wanted to take over control of it so they could do some things like the nice refurbishment that they did to the community building that's just a block or so away from here that they did such a wonderful job with. but it was creating all kinds of problems because there was a line in the Iowa code that said that cities could not gift property. They couldn't, you know, sell it for a dollar or something like that, not allowed. So I had to actually sponsor a bill and get a bill started to allow that to happen. And it happened to have been that year. It was the only Republican sponsored bill that got through the legislature and was signed by the governor that year. So I always think about that when I'm down here at the fairgrounds. One thing that's high on a lot of people's minds this year is health care, whether it be medical health care, mental health care. Those issues have been talked about a lot this year. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that we got done this last year and providing some more options for health care. There's a problem right now with especially small business people and individuals that don't have a employer health care right now, and they don't qualify for the subsidies through the ACA, so they don't have many choices. They've got one choice basically for the health insurance, and it's extremely expensive. I have some constituents have told me that they're paying over $30,000 a year for their health care policy. And so we created a new policy that they'll be able to use that should be out here in the next very soon now. We've been told that it's going to be about half the cost of that insurance. So it'll give people another option. We had a historic mental health bill that we passed this last year that's going to fill a lot of the gaps in mental health, the mental health system, create some local access centers and a lot of other good things that will take care of some of the gaps that we have in health care. And one of the things that I think is coming this next year, the governor has appointed a Blue Ribbon Task Force, and they are looking right now at forming a little bit better organized children's health care system than what we have currently. So I think that'll be something that will definitely be coming this coming year. And then I wanted to end by talking just briefly about the budget. The budget is in great shape right now. We've got a surplus. The rainy day funds are completely full. My opponent, she may talk about this. She talked about it the last forum we were at. About $500 million in tax credits that we can just take those and could use that for other places in the budget. But it's not true because, well, first of all, that includes things like the earned income tax credit, for example. There's a lot of other tax credits that are part of that, other energy tax credits, things like that. So there's some reasons why, and we'll go into it a little bit more. I'm sure we'll have time tonight to go into more detail.
Thank you, David. Brenda.
My name is Brenda Brink. I live near Huxley. I grew up in southwest Iowa, and one of the reasons that I wanted to get into the race is that I had been down to the Capitol quite a bit. And as a person who's lived in Iowa my whole life, you know, growing up with pretty high expectations, you know, 4-H leaders, parents, teachers, that was something where I'd always assumed that the people who would be at the leadership level would be having the best ideas and the heart of the people at their forefront. And when I would go down to the Capitol and lobby for things as a citizen, I felt like there was a lot of things happening that just a person didn't count much anymore. There are many lobbyists down there. They're not all corporate lobbyists, but I can tell you that there are a lot of lobbyists who are associated with corporations, and I think that's what's showing with where the budget's going now. There are many, many tax breaks, tax cuts, tax exemptions going to corporations, and some of the corporations don't even headquarter here in Iowa anymore. So if they're a Fortune 500 company, what is the balance? It's an imbalance because you've got people who are hurting for services. I go up to Hardin County quite a bit because that's, as you said, the north end of our district. And there's a group there called the Hardin County Circle of Life. And these are people who are dealing with the after effects of not enough money being put in to help people that little bit that they need, whether it's children, whether it's single mothers, whether it's for substance abuse, and just plain education. How about some child care? There's a lot of child care deserts in Iowa. Hardin County and Story County have child care deserts. And even when you talk to people who can basically afford child care right now, it's taking a huge chunk of their family budget. And if we could really put that money to help people with child care credits, we could also help provide child care in those deserts as well. So we are looking at things that help people. There are things that we could do, and yet I feel like the taxpayer money that we have available in this rich state of ours is kind of going over and just kind of going in the pockets of a lot of corporations that shouldn't really be operating with taxpayer money. I mean, this is, you know, if it's a good business, it should be running without taxpayer money. And that's where I feel like we need to look ahead. There are things we need to do with sustainability in our agriculture system. You know, the Leopold Center was essentially closed for all practical purposes. That's the sustainability center that is really, really worldwide renowned. And now most of its projects are just leaving the state. They're not able to keep it up. There's things like, well, I'm thinking of the whole Medicaid problem. So when we have a private business, you can generally expect that's going to cost at least double, if not more, because they have to protect their bottom line. That's what a business does. So when the rollout of the Medicaid managed care system went into place, somehow our state did not look what had happened at other states who had done this. There are other states who tried to do it and finally just said, this isn't working, this needs to be revamped. But yet our state went ahead and did it without much public input, if at all. So the public hearings that I have been to, at least two public hearings and many hearings or meetings of people involved with managed care, and there are both providers and clients, and it is still an absolute mess. So when we go ahead and give them more money when they haven't even shown that they can manage what they are entrusted to do, there's just problems. There's a lot of problems with that. I'm a person that just doesn't talk. I do. So that's the way I operate. I've been knocking doors. That's the way I feel like any public servant should do. So when I go out and I talk to people at their doors, I've knocked over 5,100 doors. And about a third of those doors, I have conversations with people. So those conversations are what continue to guide me, and that is why I'm running.
Thank you, Brenda. Audience, it's your turn to ask questions. And candidates, you will have 2 minutes to answer, and we'll take turns.
My name is Jane Punk. I live in Nevada.
In 2010, the voters of the state passed the referendum to establish this Conservation and Recreation Fund. Why has the legislature not addressed that issue?
Thanks for the question, Jane. So what the voters passed was a ballot initiative, and it was 3/8 of a cent. And the ballot initiative said if the legislature increases the sales tax, the first 3/8 of a penny that they increase will go towards conservation, you know, water quality program, parks, things like that. So what's happened since then is that the legislature has not increased the sales tax since then. There's various reasons for that. Arguments over, do you just increase it 3/8 of a penny or do you increase it a full penny? That is an argument. That's something that people are discussing down there about which to do. You know, I mean, obviously, as Republicans, we don't like to increase taxes very much, so that'd be a difficult thing for us to want to have to do to increase taxes. But I can also tell you that generally Democrats don't like sales taxes either, or taxes that have the funds, a lot of strings attached to the funds. It's something that's probably fairly heavy lift for the legislature to do, but there is discussions about it. Some of the discussion involves, you know, if we continue to need more and more money for Medicaid because of federal requirements and the fact that program is continuing to cost more. You know, that's one possibility. This last couple of years, we were discussing water quality, and so that was another possible way that we could have paid for water quality. But we did pass a dedicated way to pay for that with revenues that are with the infrastructure fund.
Thank you, Dave. Brenda.
I'm on record as supporting that.
I'm Charlene Darbo, and I live in Fernald. And this is for Brenda Brink. I don't understand the problem of people not having enough food, because there's just food everywhere. With the food pantries we have, and I have seen the warehouse they have in Des Moines just on TV, and it's huge. And then also, I really have a problem with subsidizing daycare. You know, if you're going to work, and sure, it makes it tough to make ends meet if you have to pay daycare, but then if you don't make enough to live on after you pay daycare, maybe you should not be working, if that's possible. And we have assistance programs to support these people. I know it's not great, but you made your bed and you'll have to sleep in it, as far as I'm concerned. And then also, I don't like the lobbyists because they're the only ones basically that are really able to go and harass you people and get what they want if they can. The rest of us down here, we have no ability to do that.
Thank you, Charlene. Brenda?
I know people who work in many food pantries, and it is still a struggle. And one of the things that is a problem right now is that even though we have this unemployment rate, the real wages for people have gone down. What I mean by real wages is when you factor in the cost of living, whether it's housing, transportation, whatever, real wages have gone down. So when you are a single parent and you've got these things like trying to keep a car running, you know, the housing costs are quite expensive for most people who don't make much, then the food sometimes is just that much more difficult. And you look at Fernald or places where it's cheap to live or maybe out in the country, then you have to drive again, maybe someplace to get cheap food, like the Aldi's in Ames is pretty cheap food, but it's tough. It's tough. I've been the vegetable superintendent at the county fair here, and I would like to see more emphasis on gardening, but it takes people to help with that. It takes volunteers, and people seem to be stretched with their time as it is, whether you're older and a grandparent. I think that's one place where we can really help people understand valuable food. I'm a dietitian by trade. I don't really want people spending their money on packaged food, but it's tough to make the inroads into good quality food when you have people who didn't grow up that way. So that's one thing I would like. And anyway, back to the childcare, there are a lot of people who just are single parents, and childcare is tough. Like I say, I've been going up to Hardin County, and that's a big issue up there, is how do you get people to run childcare when they don't make much money running the childcare? It's a tough issue, and that's where I think government can help pull that together in some piece.
Thank you,
Brenda. Dave. As far as the food question and the child care, I think I'll just kind of answer them together. Kind of, it's just like a lot of things. It's we could just spend tons of money on all kinds of wonderful things, but you know there's a limited amount of money. We don't have a money tree. So one of the things that concerned me when we passed the preschool program a few years ago, was. We'd had a program before that was basically essentially scholarships for it operated like scholarships for preschool a bit like that, and it prioritized people that were poor that couldn't afford it. One of the problems that we did was with that preschool program was that it basically there's no means testing. It's just basically free for everybody, whether you could afford it or not. And it cost the state a lot more money than it would have otherwise. So there's some smart ways that we can do some of these programs. One of the things I did want to touch on that didn't get answered, though, was the lobbyist question. You can't get rid of lobbyists because the First Amendment of the Constitution includes the right to be able to come and lobby your legislature, which Brenda mentioned earlier that she's done as a citizen. And so people have that right to do that. People have the right, if they want to pay somebody to do it for them, to do that, too. So we have to have lobbyists at the Capitol because it's constitutionally required. But I will tell you that as a legislator, what you find out after getting to know a lot of these folks is that their credibility is the only thing they have to go by. If they lose credibility, if they lie to you, you remember that. And so what ends up happening actually is I can tell you that the lobbyists are some of the most honest people that we deal with down there because they have to be. If they're not truthful with us, we won't pay any attention to them. And so they're a good source of information, actually.
Thank you. Next question.
Hello. I'm John Monroe. I'm from Nevada. And actually, this is a question for Representative Dio. At a meeting in Story City a year and a half ago, you looked me and a group of voters right in the eye, and you said you were going to tweak and make minimal changes to collective bargaining policy for public employees. We saw where that went. So, in the next legislative session, do you intend to tweak or make minimal changes to IPERS?
So let me start, first of all, with the comments that I made up at Story City. And I've heard this charge that's been made, and I never said that we were going to tweak it. I never said. You may have misunderstood what I was saying. What I said was that the collective bargaining bill would have that unions would still have the right to bargain, they would still have the right to organize, to have arbitration, which they had before. They still have the right to arbitration. So all of those rights are still there. We made changes within all of that, and we may disagree as, you know, how far those went and how what the impact of that's going to be. But we never did say we were going to tweak it. And let me also point out that the Iowa legislature, the House Republicans, back in 2011, passed a bill that went even further with the collective bargaining than what we passed last year. It actually had a provision in it that said that if you were a labor union member, you could be a free agent, which means basically that the union then would no longer have an exclusive right to represent everybody in the workplace. So the Iowa legislature, the House Republicans, had already passed a bill in 2011 already. So I think that was a pretty good indication that was one of the ways that we would probably be heading with this issue. As far as IPERS, we passed a resolution last year saying we were not going to change IPERS. Every Republican, I think every Democrat in the House passed that resolution. The governor stated that she's not going to support it. The House Speaker has come out and said she's not going to support it. Leadership is opposed to doing anything. The bill that some folks are sort of hanging their hat on, that the legislature supposedly had a bill, you know, 2 years ago, was a bill sponsored by one individual legislator, and it didn't go anywhere. So,
thank you, Dave.
I'm totally opposed to changing IPERS. It's not only important for our hardworking, high-quality employees, but it's also a promise that we made, and it's working very well. There's no reason to change it, and I would totally work hard against the change.
My name is Susan Lequin. I live here in Nevada. And Dave, you had brought up tonight about the mental health centers, increasing those. What kind of quality of staff will you have? And will it be affordable to those that need it?
Actually, it's Brenda's turn.
Okay. Well, basically, the bill that was passed to regionalize mental health is one of the kind of things that looks good on the surface. But if there's no sustainable funding source for it, which is the case, then things are kind of like, well, what do we do with this? Where do we actually take this? It's a good idea. It needed to be done. But we have this saying in our house, who's paying for that? We need to decide as a state that mental health is important. And again, I keep going back to the money that is leaking out of this state. If we aren't examining all the tax breaks, tax cuts, tax exemptions, as we need to be doing, then we are allowing that money to go to places where they don't really need it, and we are allowing people and families who need mental health needs to go untreated, to go to other states. Providers are not able to stay in business. It's the whole realm of things. And I can tell you, I was surprised how many people have mentioned mental health because it is such a problem in our state. So we need to address it, and we need to go where the money is, and that is the places and the businesses that aren't needing it and that it needs to go to people.
Thank you. David.
One of my concerns with the political debate on mental health is that a lot of the talking points have not been correct. There's been a statement made in a lot of TV ads that have said that we've cut mental health funding, and it's not true. We're actually spending $500 million more on mental health than we were just 5 years ago. If you look at all mental health funding statewide, and that includes state, county, the counties, you know, historically here in Iowa, had a huge part of the funding for mental health, and it's over time it's changed. You know, we changed it when we did the regionalization about 5 years ago, and that has created some great new programs. Counties are expanding programs. I can just tell you, we were up at Hardin County the other day, and I asked them if they had cut programs, if they've expanded programs. There's been no cuts. They've been expanding programs. It was only just maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there was only 14 jail diversion programs, for example. Story County was one of the first ones. Now we're up to somewhere around 85 new jail diversion programs in the state of Iowa. So that's just one example. So we are funding a lot of expansion right now in some of the services. What you mentioned as far as the new centers and everything that we passed in the bill. We passed the first portion of that. We passed funding for that. It was in the appropriation bills that we passed this past year, so the first step has been funded already. Currently, right now, revenue for the state of Iowa, we're, 4 or 5 months into the fiscal year, starts at July 1. Revenue in the state of Iowa is up between about 6 to 7% right now. So we've got healthy revenue growth right now. I expect that we will be funding, you know, all of these the access centers, the local. There's a whole myriad of different things that are part of that. You also have to remember that a portion of it is funded by the federal government too. It's a shared program, so it's not all on Iowa to fund the whole thing.
Thank you.
I'm Leroy Kester from Story City. I would be curious if you start answering the question as to whether you've read the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change paper, which gives us the 10 to 12 years to get our act together. And with that in mind, what are your plans to improve sustainable agriculture options in Iowa? And what are you going to do to reduce the negative impacts that we have from too much carbon, too much methane, too much nitrous oxide getting into the atmosphere? I think when the state saw a need to increase our road use tax, gasoline tax, it was done to improve our infrastructure. If you understood the urgency of responding to climate change, that's about a 5 times bigger urgency than improving the roads.
Thank you, Leroy. Dave, that's to you first.
Okay. Oh, have I read the report? I read one quite a few years ago. I haven't read any. There's been a lot of them since then that I haven't read. So I've read it.
It came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I haven't read that one. No, I have not read that. Sustainable agriculture, that was the next part of your question. Sustainable agriculture, there's a lot of things that we're working on, you know, and there's a lot of things that we're learning. A lot of the practices that have been started now that you see out there in the fields this time of the year, you're starting to see a few fields that have cover crops. I wouldn't say they were never done, because occasionally people double cropped and did things like that, but we're learning more and more about the benefits of those type of practices. As far as the ability to hold nitrogen in the soil and improve organic matter. And so there's still a lot of work to do, I think, on understanding what are the best practices and the best ways to be successful at doing it. And we've passed a bill, multiple bills, actually, in the last several years that are working towards that. And we're going to continue to push that issue and make sure that it continues to be funded, because I think that's important. I think all of us want to have, the cleanest water possible. The second part of your question. Did you just ask something in general about global warming or
improving sustainability? Reducing negative impacts.
Okay, and reducing impacts. Yeah. So I agree that there is there's climate change. I won't say warming, because actually there's quite a bit of evidence that it hasn't warmed as much as what these models said it was going to. And so climate change, yes, there has been change in the climate, and there's always been change in the climate. We've had climate changing for multiple, millennium over history. This building right where we're sitting right here, 12,000 to 14,000 years ago, was under about 1,000 feet of ice. I guess just as a rhetorical question, I might ask, well, what's normal? Is it normal to have had, be covered in ice under this area? Because this was part of during the last ice age, this area was covered with that.
Thank you, Dave. Brenda.
It's clear that the globe is getting warmer, and I actually brought with me the news release about that. And this just, to me, epitomizes what is the difference between the way the legislature has been acting the last few years and what we need to do. We need to think forward. We need to start to mitigate. We need to do it now. I was very upset about the pipeline going through Iowa for lots of reasons. Eminent domain for a pipeline, that's no good. The fact that they're still fighting about whether or not there's adequate insurance coverage, they're still fighting about that. So I have been very adamant that I must, as a citizen, do all I can with helping to stop the use of carbon fuels. Then we get into sustainable ag. There is so much we could be doing. Sequestering carbon in the soil, that would be a win-win. We could be a leader. We could be where everyone comes to learn from. And yet, all of a sudden, the Leopold Center is on the chopping block. I still don't understand that. And if we don't have things going toward the future, we're just going to wither away, whether it's the kids are never coming home, whether it's, you know, only certain urban centers get to have the nice things, whether it's we don't really care about people in Iowa having meals on wheels or getting adequate health care. So I think that we need to bring these things back home, and I think it's only right that we do that for the future. And that's where I think there's a big difference between us two candidates.
Thank you. Next question.
Yeah, I'm Catherine Barber from Escondido. The governor rather gleefully announced at her first debate that we had a $127 million surplus, which came as a surprise, I think, even to some legislators. Given that you gave education, K through 12 education, 1%, which means that they, you know, not only could they not keep up with inflation, they could barely keep the doors open. And given that you have this surplus, and hopefully you don't spend it all on the Medicaid money that you shouldn't be spending it on for corporations that aren't paying their providers, what do you think the percentage increase should be for K through 12 education that you will provide in next year's session?
It's a little early yet. When we look at our budget, we already see the revenue estimating conference comes in December and gives us the actual total revenue increase that they estimate that we're going to have for the next fiscal year. So for out of the last 6 years, the first 5 years, they were overestimating revenue every year. We would get an estimate in December, and then when we would get to the end of the fiscal year, we would be short. And those numbers were anywhere from 100 million to, I think, around 300 million in rough figures that they were running short each year. And so we were actually having to fill those holes. For the first 3 years, we filled them with reserves that we had. We had reserves enough to basically fill those holes at the end of the year when their estimates were off. And we continued to try and, you know, negotiate with the Senate, because then it was with the Senate Democrats and Mike Gronstall. We would have to negotiate the budgets with them. And this past year budget was the first budget that was a Republican budget, signed by the governors, passed by both houses. So basically just this one, for 2018 fiscal year, which just ended this past the end of June. And yes, we ended up with $127 million extra surplus, which is, you know, in the whole scheme of things, it's really not that large, you know, compared to some of the shortfalls that we had. It's very similar. We had the REC had been telling us that I think it was going to be around $30 million or something like that. So we had more than we had, and so good. It sure makes things a lot easier when they finally underestimated the revenue and we had a little bit better revenue growth than we had.
I think that we should be thinking about the stresses that modern day life puts on children and families, and the frontline people are the teachers. So anytime we can get some more support staff in there, anytime we can look at the needs of the schools, I think that's the place to put it.
Before we conclude, I want to remind everyone to vote on Tuesday, November 6th. The polls are open 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., and also early voting is going on now. Thank you all for a very informative evening. Thank you all for your questions and your participation here tonight.
You have been listening to a candidates forum for the Iowa House of Representatives for District 49. The candidates you heard were the incumbent Republican Dave Deo, Democrat Brenda Brink. Candidate John Evans did not attend the forum or send a message to read. This forum was hosted by the League of Women Voters and took place on October 25th, 2018 in Nevada. I have been your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening to Local Talk, which airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here at KHOI. Remember, KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. You still can register to vote up until Election Day, but bring an ID and proof of residency. You can find information about registering and voting at 411.org. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible, and you, the voter, are what makes democracy meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.